Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the Longevity Now podcast, the place for all your news and views of life extension from around the world. Following rejuvenation and life extension research through the years has introduced me to an incredible amount of information about various supplements and biohacking techniques to beat back aging. So, I'm surprised when I learn something new, something that has been proven to generate substantial health benefits and fight several diseases, yet hardly anyone knows about it. In this episode, we speak with Professor Clifford Steer of the University of Minnesota. He has had a long career studying the liver and associated diseases and has had a lot of success treating many conditions. You can also find out about one particular substance that is unknown to many but has dramatic protective effects in human cells. And now I would like to welcome to the Longevity Now podcast, Professor Clifford Steer of the University of Minnesota. Welcome.
Thank you. And it's a pleasure being here.
I'll tell you what, the Longevity audience is very interested in many of the different research avenues you've pursued throughout your career. And just to get everyone on the same page, give us a little background on your research history and some of the different projects you've worked on, just briefly.
Okay. I went to undergraduate at the University of Minnesota back in the mid-60s, and I went to medical school at the University of Minnesota, did a residency in internal medicine, and then I went out to the National Institutes of Health for a three-year fellowship in liver diseases. I was bitten by the bug to do research and stayed at the NIH for about 14 years, at which time a family situation brought me back to the University of Minnesota, and I've been back ever since. While at the NIH, I did a myriad of different types of research, primarily focusing on liver. I did a number of studies on receptor-mediated endocytosis. I did a number of studies on characterizing different receptors on hepatocytes, Kupffer cells, sinusoidal endothelial cells of the liver, a lot of gene therapy, a lot of work on liver regeneration. And I was also a member of a three-team group, three individuals who created the drug glucocerebrosidase, or Seridase, which is the standard of care drug for patients with Gaucher's disease. So I'm very, very proud of that. And it really was an outstanding collaboration between Scotty Ferbus, John Berenger, and myself in bringing this drug to market. And that was eventually commercialized by Genzyme. It was, I think, approved in 1985 or 1987, and it was at that time the most expensive drug in the world. It is now the fifth most expensive drug in the world and still standard of care. And again, it just makes me feel good that I was able to contribute a significant component to the development of that drug. When I moved back to Minnesota, I continued work on receptor-mediated endocytosis. I got very much involved with liver regeneration. I got significantly involved with gene therapy, particularly non-viral gene therapy. Did some really outstanding studies. We actually were doing gene editing 20 years before CRISPR was even a household name. That was in the late 90s, early 2000s. That technology was written up in Time magazine, and unfortunately, it experienced some political issues, and we had to step away from that technology and focus in on something called Sleeping Beauty, which again is a non-viral gene therapy. We've cured a number of liver diseases using Sleeping Beauty, and we did a number of different studies on liver regeneration. Over the last 10 years, I've been particularly involved in regenerative medicine, and I've had a couple of large NIH grants to fund projects on how to create human livers in pigs so that an individual who has a chronic liver disease ultimately knows that eventually they'll require a liver transplant, and there's actually a pig walking around with that person's immunologically identical liver for transplantation. The reason for this, Justin, is because last year there were 25,000 people who needed liver transplants, and only about 6,000 to 7,000 got transplants. Many of those others died simply because transplants were not available. So
let me stop you at that point here. Since we're talking about your recent liver research, let's start out with that topic a bit. And I have read that liver disease is increasing mainly from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, whereas it used to be mainly alcoholics who would suffer liver complications as they age, but now different modalities are arriving onto the scene. Is that what you've seen as well?
Absolutely. You know, years ago, it was alcoholic liver disease, hepatitis B, hepatitis C. But we now know that Harvey Alter, who was at NIH, and I worked with Harvey for many years, got the Nobel Prize for finding, for identifying hepatitis C and also curing hepatitis C. So at the end of the day, the major concern for liver diseases now is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which ultimately turns into non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which turns into cirrhosis, which turns into end-stage liver disease. And many of those patients are going to need livers in the future.
And the cure for hepatitis C, just remind me about that, that it is treatable, and remind our audience, what is the standard protocol of care for hepatitis C infection?
Well, the standard of care now, of course, you have several different medications from which to choose, depending on the hepatitis C phenotype that you have or species that you have. I think about 95% of these people are actually cured of their hepatitis C, which means that there is absolutely no hepatitis C detectable in the bloodstream or tissues or whatever. There aren't too many cures in medicine, but hepatitis C is now a curable disease. I believe it's a little bit pricey, but at the end of the day, most healthcare programs are paying for the treatment.
And it's easy enough for people to be screened for hepatitis C. That's something, as people age, they should probably get tested for.
Piece of cake. Absolutely. Yeah. It's meat and potatoes. Absolutely. It's just standard of care.
Yeah. Speaking of that, it's a curable liver disease, but we've got some other issues with the liver, and you've been working on regenerative therapies. And how would you say things have been progressing in the last few years with the avenues that you've taken, like with the Sleeping Beauty that you mentioned?
So at the end of the day, the Sleeping Beauty is a modality for non-viral gene therapy. Okay. And we've been doing this for many, many, many years. Many of the liver diseases out there, alpha-1 antitrypsin, Krigler-Najjar syndrome, hemophilia B, hemophilia A, these are single point mutations in a gene. One single point mutation out of 3 billion base pairs is off key, and that produces a horrific disease. Okay. So at the end of the day, the development of CRISPR comes at a great time, because CRISPR gives us the ability to basically rewrite that genetic code. And with efficient delivery of the appropriate molecules to hepatocytes or to sinusoidal endothelial cells, it makes it really quite feasible to literally correct that single base pair and cure the disease. So let me.
It only needs, now, just to be clear, it only needs to be edited, or that gene needs to be repaired in the liver.
You can do it in the liver, in vivo, in the liver. And again, the majority of the liver diseases are single point mutations. In other words, one single base pair is off kilter. It's the same with sickle cell disease. It's just one single codon. That's it. Okay. So the bottom line is, you know, in real estate, location, location, location dictates the, you know, the value of a home. In gene therapy, delivery, delivery, delivery dictates the success of that gene therapy, okay? And it turns out that my laboratory is very facile and very experienced in delivering nanoparticles and everything else to hepatocytes and non-hepatocytes within the liver. It's all about delivery.
And the success you've seen so far, have you been able to cure single gene liver diseases so far in people? I'm not completely up to speed on the trials that you've run.
Okay. So I have not run personally any clinical trials. Okay.
Okay.
But we have cured diseases in mice, transgenic genes. These are genes that are human genes and transgenic animals. And we've cured hemophilia A, we've cured Krigler-Najjar syndrome in the gun rat, and the list goes on and on and on. And it's just a matter of time. I think there are certainly a number of clinical trials going on worldwide to gene edit many of these diseases, but they so are amenable to treatment that it's a good time for CRISPR to have come along.
Yes, it certainly is. I was wondering about, now this is just a kind of a, I'm theorizing here about the use of CRISPR or gene editing in the liver alone to, say, cure a single genetically driven disease. Does it matter that the rest of your body would have that single gene mutation? Because oftentimes, I'm just thinking in the global perspective, your body has a blueprint, and that gene is part of the blueprint. And if you just change one part of your body, would the rest of your cells in your body still try to drive the liver toward that disease yet? Because not every cell in your body has received the gene editing.
Okay. And the answer to that is 99% of the time, it's going to be liver and liver alone. And let me just give you an example. Hepatocytes produce factor VII for hemophilia B. Okay. It's primarily among little boys. It's a male dominant disease. All you have to do is repair 2%. That is 2% of the gene pool in the liver to allow that little boy to go out and play hockey without any concern whatsoever about bleeding. 2%.
Is that what you've seen in my mouse trials?
It's even less. But again, you know, mice and you're still talking a little bit of different species of apples, you know.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Mice
and humans. But at the end of the day, 2%. For hemophilia factor VIII, exactly the same, 2%. For Crigler-Najjar, you have to correct about 15% of the gene pool to keep those kids from not requiring blue light for 12 to 15 hours a day. Okay. I'm very familiar with that disease. It's a fascinating single point mutation. It's a very rare disease. We were set up to do a clinical trial in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, among the Amish group because of the inbreeding within the Amish community. Crigler-Najjar is, that's where you're going to find most of the patients in this country. And there are very, very few patients who have that disease, an enormously amenable disease to single point gene editing and cure, not correction, but cure.
Yeah. And has this been followed long term? Because I'm just thinking changing a few cells in the liver, it being one of the most regenerative organs of the body, I would tend to think that maybe those gene edited cells, hepatocytes, might be crowded out as the liver goes through various stages of regeneration, and that the disease cells would take over again. Or am I wrong in that?
Well, your point is well taken. Liver regeneration is probably the most regenerative organ in the body. But at the end of the day, though, if you leave a normal liver alone, the rate of regeneration and replication of hepatocytes is very minimal. Mm. And in fact, studies have been done to try to figure out how often does a hepatocyte actually replicate. And it turns out anywhere from 2 to 20 years. So you can have hepatocytes there that are 20 years old. At the end of the day, gene editing does something that few gene therapies can do. It permanently rewrites the genetic code. So when the cell does replicate, it replicates to the correct gene sequence. Okay. So at the end of the day, all you have to do it is one time. And if you can cure the disease on day one, most likely that disease will be cured 10 years later and even 20 years later.
Okay, moving on, the liver disease, obviously very important because a crucial organ for functioning as you get older, obviously. And cirrhosis of the liver, not a single gene mutation disease. Do you have any insights into curing cirrhosis? Is there any research going on in that regard, or is it just boiled down to you need a new liver?
Basically, you need a new liver, okay? And the reason is very simple. Once the liver becomes cirrhotic, it becomes one giant ball of scar tissue. Okay. There are no cells there to replicate. You can take a liver, a human liver, cut 80% of it out. And 2 months later, that liver will be back to normal size. 2 months later.
Why? A healthy liver. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because the hepatocytes that you left behind are, you know, they receive the signal that something's wrong. They start replicating. And all of a sudden, 2 months later, you have a normal liver. If you do that to a cirrhotic liver, at the end of the day, that individual is going to die, pure and simple. And the reason is because there are no hepatocytes around to replicate. And even if they do want to replicate, there's so much scar tissue, there isn't a place physically for them to replicate. So they're basically confined by the scar tissue itself.
And if there, unless there is a way to repair the scar tissue, then you can't just regenerate that liver in situ. You just need a new liver.
Yes. And of course, you know, studies are being done to try to reduce fibrosis, but not cirrhosis. Cirrhosis is end stage. Fibrosis, that's where all of a sudden you realize, hey, there's some scar tissue developing, et cetera, et cetera. Let's nip it in the bud before it gets out of control, before the liver becomes cirrhotic. But to my knowledge, nobody is taking the time or spending the money to try to figure out how to reverse a cirrhotic liver. And that sort of brings us to xenotransplantation, blastocyst complementation, and everything that we were just talking about.
And that is something definitely worth pursuing yet, because obviously there's so many people that need liver transplants. You know, there's just no way to reverse that scar tissue. So we just need the transplants. That's
the estimate now for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is that there are 50 million Americans walking around. All you have to do is go to the Minnesota State Fair, and it gives you a good appreciation of the issues of obesity in this country. And everybody knows that obesity is a critical factor. You know, at the end of the day, what's the major cause of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Obesity.
Yeah. Well, let's switch topics now to the one other single gene disease that you have had some focus on with Huntington's disease and the use of ursodeoxycholic acid.
Yes.
And that was early in your research career. And this is a liver bile acid, one component that seems to reduce the symptoms or slow the progressions of Huntington's disease. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think it's probably important for me to provide the audience with just a 2-minute overview of.
Yes, history. Please do.
So at the end of the day, Cecilia Rodriguez was a visiting professor from the University of Portugal in Lisbon, University of Lisbon. And Cecilia and I had done some bile acid work when she was in Ken Setchell's laboratory in Cincinnati getting her PhD. And she came to my laboratory back in 97, 98, something like that, to do about 6 months or a year of molecular biology. And one day she had a little bit of time on her hands and decided to examine some livers that we had treated with both sort of toxic bile acids and ursodeoxycholic acid. And to our sort of surprise, pleasant surprise, we realized that those livers or those animals that had taken the UDCA had normal livers. And the fact of the matter is the toxic bile acids, the more hydrophobic bile acids, didn't seem to be as injurious to those livers as those animals who were not receiving the UDCA. So fast forward, we decided to do some cell culture studies and looked at a number of different agents. And about 6 months later, we came to the conclusion that UDCA worked by actually a mechanism that involved mitochondrial function. It was receptor mediated. And at the end of the day, it made no difference what the injurious agent was in terms of inducing cell death, apoptosis. And to our surprise, not only did ursodeoxycholic acid work to protect liver cells, but it also worked to protect every other type of cell that we tested. And we probably tested 20 or 30 different types of cells. So what we realized was that, wow, we have something here that is really quite remarkable. We published a number of papers, and the first paper we published was in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, published a number of other papers showing that ursodeoxycholic acid stabilized the mitochondrial permeability potential, reduced reactive oxygen species, reduced caspase activation, and the list goes on and on and on and on. And basically, over the course of time, we determined the mechanisms, the pleiotrophic mechanisms that UDCA had in the cell. We realized that it was remarkable in terms of its ability to keep cells from dying and as a pro-survival agent as well. We therefore reached out to somebody who had some models of acute stroke, Huntington's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, Parkinson's disease, and the list goes on and on and on. We published a number of papers, all with animal studies, basically showing that ursodeoxycholic acid could significantly slow the progression of any of these neurodegenerative diseases, including myocardial infarction, acute stroke, retinitis pigmentosa, acute kidney injury. And again, the list goes on and on and on. When I lecture to students, I tell them, I'm going to talk to you about the greatest drug in the world today that nobody's ever heard of.
And that's right. And I had not heard of it previously either, even though when I read the research, the previous research and your research on it, I wondered why it isn't being used more. Could you speculate on that just a little bit?
Well, first of all, let me go. And what I'd like to do is quote Mother Nature. Okay. What do black bears and squirrels and all rodents do that we don't do during the winter? They hibernate. When a black bear hibernates, it increases its ursodeoxycholic acid from less than 10% to making up 50 to 60% of the bile acid pool. What you're looking at here is Mother Nature's gift to hibernating animals. And every single hibernating animal has sky-high levels of ursodeoxycholic acid. It's Mother Nature's gift to keep these animals safe and alive. If you and I were to hibernate for 6 months, there wouldn't be anything left of us, okay? So the bottom line is, it was fortuitous that in my laboratory, we made this really seminal and remarkable discovery that ursodeoxycholic acid is remarkable in terms of its ability to keep cells from dying. I have worked with the National Football League for traumatic brain injury. I have worked with the National Hockey League. I have been in contact many times with NASA to put their astronauts on ursodeoxycholic acid. Why? Because of the radiation injury and the significant cell death that astronauts experience when they are in the space station for 6 months. They lose IQ, they lose brain cells, and I can't even imagine what's going to happen to these people when they take a two-year travel to Mars and back with that type of exposure. It turns out that ursodeoxycholic acid actually inhibits radiation-induced cell death that you would get in space. So you know what? I've been very, very busy over these last two decades, really educating and negotiating with some of these high-end programs like the National Football League, like the National Hockey League, like NASA, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I've often said, you know what? Fluoride was put in our water. We should put two other things in our water, a statin and UDCA.
Is UDCA just, you think that it's not being used as much, it's not that widespread, it's not that well known because it's not something that can be patented and sold at a high price or something like that?
Bingo. That's exactly what happened. So, you know, what we did was we created a use patent from the University of Minnesota many, many years ago, and we just couldn't find anybody interested in a use patent. UDCA was patented about 40 years ago for the treatment of primary biliary cholangitis. It used to be called primary biliary cirrhosis. And that patent, of course, is awful. It, you know, it's generic now, and there's no money in UDCA. What Amylyx did, the pharmaceutical company in Boston, is they combined TUDCA together with phenylbutyrate and created a patentable molecule that they are commercializing for Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, they've been very, very successful. And at the end of the day, phenylbutyrate, the reason they put the phenylbutyrate in there is because, well, first of all, to make it a patentable molecule. And number two, it turns out that phenylbutyrate modulates the unfolded protein response of endoplasmic reticulum. Well, guess what? Ursodeoxycholic acid does it and actually does it even better. So the reason for TUDCA is because the taurine UDCA, again, is more patentable than UDCA. But the difference between TUDCA and UDCA is minimal at best, perhaps 10% more efficient. But that's it.
That's it. Yeah. So it would be much more useful to society just to use the UDCA is what you would say. Yeah.
And the cost would be significantly less.
Less. Yes. Now, can you illuminate me? Do you know, does UDCA cross the blood-brain barrier?
It's wonderful that you asked that question. And thank you. So in 2009, we actually published a paper. We took 18 patients with Lou Gehrig's disease. Okay. And we tapped their spinal column, got permission to do it, and couldn't detect any bile acids at all, okay? And we gave them, I think it was either I think it was 2 months of UDCA, ranging in dose from 30 milligrams to 50 milligrams per kilogram body weight. And then what we did was we tapped them again and looked at the optimal dose of UDCA orally, that would cross the blood-brain barrier and give the most efficient levels of UDCA in the brain. Why? Because we were interested in curing neurodegenerative diseases. It didn't matter for an acute myocardial infarction or kidney disease, et cetera, but it did for the blood-brain barrier and neurodegenerative diseases, even stroke. Our results with stroke were amazing. We actually preserved 50%, that's 50% of the brain tissue in both ischemic and hemorrhagic stroke in animal models. 50%, nobody on planet Earth can do that for a hemorrhagic stroke in humans. Nobody. Urso did it. Okay. So the bottom line is we did the studies and we found out that it was 30 to 50 milligrams per kilogram body weight gave us the optimal levels of UDCA in the spinal fluid. And of course, three of those patients decided to stay on the Urso. And 10 years later, they were all three still alive with Lou Gehrig's disease.
Wow, that's dramatic. That is really positive results. Now, considering that UDCA is a natural occurring bile acid, right, and that you found some certain dosages that seem to work, is there a dose response curve that you've found, the toxicity perhaps of a certain level of UDCA that is not beneficial once you go above a certain level?
Well, the maximum dose that we used on the patients was 50 milligrams per kilogram body weight with basically no side effects, except maybe for a little bit of diarrhea. And actually, many of the patients actually were happy about that because they were constipated all the time. So, you know, at the end of the day, the number of side effects with UDCA or TUDCA is few and far between. The LD50 for UDCA is some incredible high number. And of course, all of those studies were done when they did the pharmaceutical analysis and the pharmacokinetics of UDCA for the treatment of primary biliary cirrhosis, literally 45 years ago. And I believe it was Seba Geigy who commercialized UDCA for PBC and gallstone dissolution, okay? It was only when we made the discovery that all of a sudden we realized that UDCA can be used for things outside of the liver and outside of gallstone dissolution. And again, you've seen the publications. Yes. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of papers out there now on UDCA.
Do you have any other thoughts about Huntington's disease and ALS and those types of brain disorders and diseases as far as curing them? Obviously, UDCA has some very positive results in slowing the progression of those diseases. But do you have any insight or any thoughts about what further research directions in the future might help to cure those diseases or reverse those diseases?
Well, again, you know, that's the holy grail. Obviously, that's where we want to go. Cure. But to give you an example, when we did our studies with retinitis pigmentosa, we treated the rats with the human retinitis pigmentosa gene for an entire 1 year. Not a single rat became blinded. Not a single rat had any pathology of the inner layer of the retina. Basically, they were cured with TUDCA, okay? Now, with all of the studies that we've done with Lou Gehrig's disease, Parkinson's disease, and Huntington's disease, you know, we weren't really setting up to cure the disease. We simply wanted to slow it down, okay? The cure to these diseases is not UDCA or TUDCA. It is stem cell treatment, gene therapy, gene editing, et cetera, et cetera. And with CRISPR, CRISPR's opened up a whole plethora of opportunities. But again, what is the critical thing in terms of treating ALS, Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, and the list goes on and on and on? Delivery.
Getting it into the brain to edit
absolutely. Mutations. And really, one of the best ways to get things into the brain, Justin, is not through a systemic route, but through the nose. And the reason is because when you spray a spray through your nose, there is no blood-brain barrier between the nasal passage.
The olfactory nerve goes.
Yeah, it goes right smack into the brain. And it really is a much better delivery system than systemically, where it goes everywhere. Okay. So the bottom line, and again, many pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies are working on nasal delivery of a myriad of different drugs, including insulin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And even now, they're developing a nasal delivery for COVID for the mRNA vaccine. So, you know, it's a good way to deliver. Again, with CRISPR, with stem cells, with gene editing, I think that you're looking at cures, hopefully within my lifetime, but only time will tell.
I want to ask one last question that one of our listeners had about using UDCA, because it does seem to be such a beneficial substance. Is there any worry that your endogenous production of UDCA would diminish if you were supplementing it exogenously? You know?
Yeah. And of course, in you and me, UDCA makes up 2% of our bile acid pool. Okay. 2%. At the end of the day, patients with PBC have been on UDCA for 40 years with no untoward effects. It's really remarkable. In fact, there's some evidence to suggest that they actually have fewer other problems than their liver disease when they've been on the UDCA. And the only caveat to using UDCA and all of the neurodegenerative diseases, okay, is the following. Start as early as possible. You want to start with ALS patients before they're in an iron lung, because you can't bring back dead tissue. That only happens in the movies, okay? And the bottom line is you want to really just flood these cells with UDCA as early on in the diagnosis as possible. It ain't going to injure the cells. It's going to keep them alive. And with HD, the advantage there, you know, tongue in cheek, the advantage there is you know how many triple repeats you have, and you know the risk factor is for developing clinical disease, et cetera, et cetera. So again, if I learned that I had the HD gene, the triple CAG repeat today, I would go on ursodeoxycholic acid yesterday, pure and simple, for the rest of my life, because we've learned from this PBC cohort that these patients can be on UDCA for decades. Granted, the dosage is significantly higher, but at the end of the day, it's not going to have any untoward effects. There are people who take UDCA who are absolutely healthy because they think it's going to keep them alive longer. I don't know the answer to that or not. Maybe it's true.
It could be true. That's right. Well, we'll leave it at that. Professor Steer, I would like to thank you very much for appearing on the Longevity Now podcast.
Well, Justin, thank you very, very much. And again, if anybody has questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to me.
As you heard at the end of the interview, Professor Steer is very willing to speak with people about UDCA or other disease treatments, hopefully fostering future beneficial research. You can find his contact information on the University of Minnesota's website. Otherwise, reflecting upon this interview, it is an unfortunate reality in the current drug development process in much of the world that simple, low-cost treatments are ignored or underutilized. The good news is that in the present day, the information is out there. Substances like UDCA are accessible to the determined biohacker or for those who suffer from various genetic diseases. Until next time, I'm Justin Lowe.